everyone, and welcome to the Indie Film Review with your host, Dan. That's me. And of course, there's Jared.
Hey, guys and gals. What's up?
So this week, we dove into the mind of a great auteur, David Lynch. Because Jared has never seen one of his films before. And I was so surprised by that because it's probably my favorite David Lynch film to date. It's called Lost Highway.
Lost Highway. Can we, before we get into it, because this is an independent film, correct? Let's talk about that for a little
bit. Okay, so after I was watching it, it says Universal, so I'm wondering if Universal just distributed it, or did Universal actually produce it? Because there's no fucking way this movie made any sort of money whatsoever. There isn't. Like, it's, I will admit right now, it's a rough sit through. It's taxing on your brain. Normal people would not like this film at all. I am actually going to be either surprised or not surprised by Jared, because as I'm watching it for, like, I don't know, the fifth time in a row, and I'm like, man, Jared's watching it with me now. I'm like, Jared's not going to like this movie.
Do you think that this film was independent when it first came out and then got, like, re-released or something?
Possibly. Or? I don't know. I feel like everything David Lynch has ever done has been independent, except for the Dune movie. That was, like, a big budget picture that he poured a lot of money into and just was a colossal flop, and he hated it afterwards. But Blue Velvet, like, that's a fucking indie movie. Like...
Okay, so looking at company credits, this is like people who distributed and the production company and everything else. I've never heard of any of these people.
So but good. It's definitely an independent film. Like, I feel like David Lynch is one of the godfathers, if you will, of indie cinema.
Yeah, I mean, Eraserhead, didn't he self-fund that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, God, I love that movie so much.
So, Lost Highway comes out a few years, maybe 4 years before Mulholland Drive, if you've ever heard. Like, typically, I don't know, to me, that film is kind of synonymous with David Lynch's name, aside from Eraserhead and Twin Peaks. Like, Mulholland Drive is like, oh, have you seen that movie? That's such a puzzle. I like Mulholland Drive, but I feel like Lost Highway is more perplexing to me. And it has a lot more to say, if that makes sense.
I remember thinking Lost Highway, or not Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive was okay. But I haven't seen it in a long time. I just remember thinking, like, oh, this is all right. It's pretty good. So Twin Peaks came out in, like, the early 90s, right? I believe this came out, like, maybe, yeah, like, 5 or 6 years after. And I was trying to think, like, did this come out before or after? Because there's so much Twin Peaks stuff going on in Lost Highway.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, which one was the progenitor of what?
My argument, though, and I've said this multiple times, I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, but I feel like everything that David Lynch touches is in the same universe.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Twin Peaks, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, all of it is the same exact universe, and it's Eraserhead. I mean, the only one that's iffy is Elephant Man and Dune, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Blue Velvet is definitely in that strange universe. It's what we perceive on a regular basis, but there's just something a little bit off.
Yeah, because we could get into the connections to, like, Twin Peaks and Lost Highway and trying to understand it from that point of view, or we could look at it from, like, okay, what is the meaning behind this film just on its own? And I think that's kind of fun. There's, like, a lot of different ways you can look
at
it.
There's so much.
Because of his body of work.
Yeah.
So, Dan, why don't you tell us, what the heck is Lost Highway?
Well, it's hard to talk about without spoiling it, let alone being hard to talk about, period. Because this movie is batshit crazy. I feel like Mulholland Drive is a little bit easier to follow, which is saying quite a bit. Because Mulholland Drive is fucking out there.
But talk about the two different characters, like, kind of what their plot summary is without the big twist of how we get to the other
characters. You have two people. You have Fred, I don't remember his last name, but he is a jazz saxophonist, and he is accused of murdering his wife.
Yeah.
And you have Pete Dayton, who is a mechanic who the local mob boss likes him a lot because he's really fast with fixing the mob boss's car. Like, it's a Mercedes-Benz, basically. Mm-hmm. And he starts to fall in love with the mob boss's side girl. And they have a crazy relationship, those two characters, because the guy's wife and the mob boss's side girl are, they look the same. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. How old is the lady who plays...
Patricia Arquette?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. She's got to be in her 40, late 40s, 50s now.
I thought, well, I mean, not now. I mean, like, during the film, because she starts a romantic relationship with this young guy.
Right.
And it that kind of adds a layer to it. Like, is she using him? You know, is this like
a absolutely. Absolutely.
It was pretty interesting. And would you think it's safe to say this film is basically... here's my synopsis of the film. Patricia Arquette gets fucked a lot.
Yeah. The movie. This is Lynch's most sexually explicit film to date. Like, if you are not okay with sexy sex going on camera, I'm kind of that way too. But I feel like the sex in this film, it doesn't service anything besides it just adds to the id of the characters. It's like their primal desire that they are constantly fulfilling. And that's one of the main motivations of both Bill Pullman's character and Balthazar Getty. So Bill Pullman is Fred. Balthazar Getty is Pete.
Yes.
And they're just driven by this desperation that only comes with... comes with sex.
Gross. Cum is gross, Dan.
I know.
Oh my God. Okay. Dan.
Yes.
Let's do some questions.
All right. Jared, did you like this movie?
I did okay, like this film.
Because you have a copy of it now.
I know. So, there are a lot of gratuitous sex scenes.
Yes.
But, a lot of it, most of them, do service the plot. Some of them actually are pretty sexy. And... yeah, I probably don't need all the sexy sex. I mean, we could... Well, but what else helps is the music in this.
Oh, God.
And the way those sex scenes are shot are just phenomenal. What? There's some things in this film I have not seen before in a movie. The way things are shot. That's pretty impressive.
Like, I want to get into revolutionary it, we'll finish questions.
Sure. When did you first watch this movie? And with whom?
I had to have been in high school, and I watched it by myself, but I was told about it by the same guy that gave me that pirated Tetsuo movie that I gave to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
See, like, we had this back and forth, me and this guy in high school, that we took turns watching fucked up movies, and we're like, have you seen this? No? Watch it. That's where I got El Topo, that's where I got... Wonder Chosen, that fucking awful TV show, if you've ever seen that. The Wicker Man, the very first time I saw The Wicker Man was in high school. I think we watched that all together. The original, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty great. Well, how did you feel about the music, though?
I love the music in it. It has fucking Rammstein in it, dude.
Yeah, how confusing. Rammstein. I was like, Rammstein is in this? What the hell?
I think it's just because Lynch likes Rammstein. And he just put them, because that was the year that their first album came out.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, I know these songs. This is so strange. It's this movie is so eclectic.
Extremely.
It feels like you're watching the film, and then it becomes a totally different film, and you're like... forgot that you were even watching. You're like, oh my God, are we in a different... It's like the odyssey that you go on. I almost forgot I was watching a film. Like, I got confused as to like where I was. But I was still interested in what was going on.
Very atmospheric and spacious, too. Like, the very first bit of it where we're following Fred around and he has suspicions about his wife... all that is super implied. Nothing is given to you. You just kind of have to exist with Fred and feel what he's feeling to really get the most out of this movie.
And everything is self-contained within his house.
Yeah.
And his house is the weirdest house. They pick, like, this strange house with these, like, tiny rectangle windows that look like prison windows.
And the weird long
hallway. And he just lives in a cartoon house. And you think, like, oh, is this, like, how low budget is this film? Are we just going to be in this house the whole time? And even the way that the first character's stuff is shot, all that stuff is so bizarre.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the younger character, it becomes like, oh, this is a movie now. It's almost like one felt like a dream and the other felt real.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're now in the real, like, how, it's so amazing that he was able to change, like, camera effects and the way he shot and the way he does all this stuff totally differently from, like, this other section of the movie. And how the transitions connect, and then it, like, loops back around and happens again towards the end.
Yeah.
It's fucking nuts. So, and then the music, too, like I said, goes from, like, beautiful original score to this, I mean...
By Angelo Badalamenti, I think his name is. But the same guy who composed Twin Peaks.
Like, oh, nice.
Lynch uses him a lot.
He's awesome. And the music in this is so good. And then you get these paid scores from musicians. It was like, I think it was like Smashing Pumpkins in this, isn't this? And Marilyn Manson, I saw.
Yeah.
And it's like, you have all these radio songs, I guess is the best way I can say it. How did you feel about that connection of original score and then these just like band musician songs mixed
this
together?
This is probably one of the more off-putting films in terms of David Lynch's use of music. I feel like sometimes the music is not so good, or I would want it to be better, and then sometimes I'm like, what the fuck is going on with this music?
It felt like off-putting.
Yes.
But I don't know if that was intentional.
This whole film, that is what this film is. Jared, one more question for you before we go into the meat and potatoes of the film.
Okay.
Because I'm going to talk about this a lot more, but how did you feel about The Mystery Man?
I love The Mystery Man.
The Mystery Man. Okay, good. Good.
The Mystery Man is amazing. He could easily be one of the people from the Red Lodge or the Black Lodge from Twin Peaks.
I don't know if you noticed this, but the first character's house has red curtains in it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. How do you not notice? It's like he puts it in your face constantly, the red curtains. So that's what makes me think a lot of that isn't even real.
Yeah.
So, oh my gosh, this movie is nuts. I recommend this movie if you like David Lynch, or if you like super weird films, or if you're some kind of horny devil that just wants to watch confusing nonsense.
I recommend this movie 100% because I made Jared watch it because it's my favorite David Lynch film. Now, I will say, and we're going to start in the middle with The Mystery Man, because it's part of my recommendation. One of my favorite moments in cinema history is the first time we see this Mystery Man.
Oh, yeah.
That whole sequence is butt-fuck insane. That I watched, the first time I watched it, I'm like, what the fuck just happened? And it gave me chills down my spine.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to watch it again and again and again. And I would say that's probably why it's my favorite movie of David Lynch's, but basically, the whole shtick of this Mystery Man is the first character, Fred, meets him at a party. And the guy's like, we've met before, haven't we? And then he's like, no, I don't think so. He's like, yeah, at your house, remember? I'm there right now. Call me. And fucking he calls him and he's at his fucking house. Oh my God. And it's chilling and it's
and the dude is just staring at him.
Oh my God. Yeah. And he has no fucking eyebrows. And it's played by Robert Blake, who at the time was about to get sentenced to prison for killing his wife.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
Did he actually go to jail?
Yes, he did.
What? That guy is already the scariest fucking person I've ever seen, and he's a real murderer in real life?
I'm pretty damn sure, yes.
Oh my God! Wow. Are there any more gems that are going to be dropping on us during this fucking...
Yeah. Well, once we get to Mr. Eddie, I'll talk about Mr. Eddie a bit.
Man, that is nuts. So, the mystery man is phenomenal. Yes. It kind of makes me sad that he's a murderer. That definitely changes my opinion of him. As far as, like, my favorite David Lynch movies, I'm trying to think. I mean, because the only thing that's missing from this is Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
But what's interesting is...
It had Jack Nance. Yeah,
oh yeah. I love Jack Nance. He's amazing in this, too. He's like, I like that tune. I like that tune. Why'd you turn it off? I'm like, oh, Jack Nance, you're the best. The character that plays the saxophonist, older man,
yeah,
could have easily been Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They even act similar and look
like...
similar.
I feel like I don't know for sure, but I feel like he might have been considered, and they just gave him like a tape of Kyle MacLachlan and say, here, do this.
Seriously, like I honestly think that Kyle probably couldn't do the role for some reason, and then they got someone else. And I'm not saying that this other person did a bad job. I think he did amazing. But it's just so strange how similarly, they tried to make this guy look and act like Kyle. It's very weird. It felt almost interchangeable. Man. I mean, I guess let's, Dan, talk about the big weird twist that IMDb likes to tell you in its fucking synopsis.
Certainly.
If you're going to watch this movie, honestly, I say watch it blind. So, like we said, we're going to really spoil this film, but we really recommend you watching it. Without knowing anything about it.
Now, okay, so basically what happens is Fred is framed for murder. We're going to talk about how insane that is, too, because that's not even close to what
actually
happens.
We gotta talk about videotapes and shit, yeah.
But basically he goes to jail, and while he's in jail, he metamorphosizes into this young kid. And there's
insane.
No explanation. The guards are like, what the hell?
Yeah.
They have to let the kid go.
There's so much detail in this and things that if you only watch this movie one time, you're going to miss. And I tried to go back and watch certain scenes again to try to figure out stuff. And even then I'm like, I'm going to have to sit down and watch this fucking movie again. Cause there's so much shit. Okay. Like when he is transforming, you see these blue lights. And they're, like, going off in this weird pattern all around him. And he's freaking out and his head is hurting and whatever, whatever. And then later on, when you're with the younger character and he's doing his robbery at that rich guy's house, the water of the pool, the lights are hitting it and it's making that same shape of, like, the dancing lights, the dancing blue lights. And I'm like, what? Does that mean something? Like, that's... That's this whole movie of, like, I'm basically just like, does that mean something? What the fuck?
Well, David Lynch has this fascination
so
with flashing lights in your face. He does that
a
lot.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
But the other thing that I wanted to bring up is Lynch, one of his most, I don't know, biggest elements. I don't know how to describe that. Like, one of the things he does the most, and it's fascinating to me, he will film inconsequential objects and then make them ominous. Like in Twin Peaks, it's the ceiling fan. He just fucking films a ceiling fan for no goddamn reason, but there's like ominous music in the background. You're like, fuck! This time it was the speaker system. That is a doorbell speaker system where like, and they just film that for a good 5 seconds. You're like, what the fuck is going on?
He puts ominous music on fucking everything.
It's
really
wonderful.
Funny. There was, like, a sex scene that had, like, ominous music.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, okay, scary sex scene? What is this? This is strange. So the movie opens up with the main character getting a buzz on his door, and he goes and clicks it, and then the guy says that Laurent is dead. You don't find out who Laurent is for so much later, and for a while, I thought the saxophonist and the young mechanic... I thought they were in two different timelines. But But then you have the detectives that are like following him around, mm-hmm. and you start meeting characters where it's like, oh, this doesn't make sense anymore. So it becomes this weird Mobius strip type of like storytelling of, I think Lynch even like described it that way, of like how interconnected these two seemingly separate stories connected by this one woman who may or may not be two different people,
mm-hmm.
who may not even exist. She might not even exist, Dan.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we should talk about the first section of the movie with the saxophonist, then get into the mechanic, and then go back to...
Okay.
Whatever we want to talk about, I guess.
So
yeah.
Basically, the draw-in to this... What makes this section interesting is Fred keeps getting envelopes on his porch of a mm-hmm. videotape. And the videotape, whenever they put it in their VCR and play it, is just a pan shot of the front of their house.
Yeah.
And that's the first one. The second one they get, it's a pan shot. It's the same exact pan shot, but then this time it cuts. And the cut goes inside their house. And then it slowly goes through all of their rooms until it just rests above them in their bed. And then they're like, oh shit, we gotta call the police.
Scary as shit, yeah. So, while this is all going on, you have the most insane dialogue of the husband and wife. Because there's so much tension in the way they talk. No other characters talk like this to each other during the film, of them just like... cryptically poking at each other and not trusting each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's a moment where you think Fred is like abusing his wife. You're like, I'm like freaked out by this, because you're like, is his wife cheating? Is he hitting her? What is going on? All this is conveyed for them, like awkwardly staring at each other. And that music again is like really tense. Then they have this sex scene, which is the most lifeless sex scene. At first I didn't know if it was intentional or not, but he has sex with his wife and she just like sits there like eyes wide open, not moving at all while he bones her. And then when he finishes, she pats him on the back.
And says it's okay.
David Lynch makes a point of zooming in on her hand, patting her on the back, like, There, you did your best. And then he's like immediately, okay, I'm going to tell you about a dream I had and it's going to be insane. But later on, when you see the sex scenes with the mechanic and mm-hmm. the blonde-haired woman, they're so much more passionate. And you're like, oh, okay. This is like, you know, what I would think a normal sex scene would be. And I like the contrasting of these two. And it... Okay. Do you think that both of these stories are, like, actually happening? Or do you think one of them maybe isn't real?
It's hard to say because of the connection to the themes throughout. I want to say one's a dream and one's not. But the dream that we're talking about, that is the first section of the movie, that, you know, it feels more dreamlike... That's the one that has all the meaningful things that I like.
Mm.
So this film is very much tied to video cameras and being able to film things anywhere you are. And Fred, he says he hates video cameras. And here's a quote. "I like to remember things my own way, how I remember them, not necessarily the way they happen."
Yeah.
So video cameras are exact replicas of how things happen, and he doesn't like that. But the video camera becomes this theme throughout, and so do memories. The kid, the mechanic, they're always asking him, "Do you remember anything?" So this idea of memory is trudging along through the background of this film.
Yeah, because something happens to him that is so traumatic that his parents will not even tell him what had happened. And then he disappears, and then he ends up in the jail cell, which is where when he replaces the saxophonist. I stopped the film and I slowed it down on the shot where it shows like the weird chicken monster thing where it's like, oh no, what happened? It looks like you're entering someone's open skull.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. Like a thing is entering someone's brain. So who the fuck knows what's going on in that? Another fun, interesting detail is when the mechanic starts the affair with the mob boss's blonde mistress.
Mm-hmm.
It shows him like boning her and they go to the hotel to secretly be together. But there's one shot where he's having sex with someone and I thought it was him at first because the person's hair was the same hair color of him, like his hair. It was like black or whatever. And I'm like, who is he boning? And then I realized, oh,
it's his girlfriend.
He is now having sex with the saxophonist's wife.
Oh, shit. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Instead of the mistress, who is played by the same character.
Yes.
And
one
and,
has blonde
and
hair, one has red hair.
They look exactly the same. Yeah, she just has a blonde wig and then she has a brunette wig. And I'm like, what the fuck? What the fuck? So it could either be that the mechanic is a younger version of the saxophonist, or maybe the saxophonist is like all of the fears and insecurities of this young kid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't decide. It
but
feels
then,
like
then at that point, where does the video camera come in? Because like that very last scene where the fucking mystery man is just ominously walking toward him, filming him with a fucking video camera.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
Where? Yes. But what does that have to do with the rest of the story?
Well, like you were saying, the video camera is memory. It's a permanent record of what's going on, and he is afraid of those things. He's afraid of looking to his past to see
that interpretation.
What he's done, or to see how things really are. And one of those big things is with the wife and with the his girlfriend, you know, because she is in this like sex trafficking porno party drug lifestyle where they make these sex films for this mob boss and he's making snuff films. Like they're killing people and filming it and she's into it. She likes all this stuff. She likes being abused and like all this crazy shit and she likes using people and she's just like a broken, strange person. And he's in denial of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So like in the first reality, it's his wife and he's trying to protect his wife from all of these bad things that she's doing. But like, that's her, like that is her core. And he's trying to deny that reality by saying, no, she's my wife. I don't care what the videotapes say. I don't care what I'm seeing on screen. I want to remember her how I remember her as her. She's my loving wife and we're in this relationship and everything is fucking fine and nothing is wrong. And of course the more he tries to look away from that, the mystery man is pulling him back in and being like, no, you need to fucking look at this. This is what's really going on. And then it becomes the mechanic and he's going through the same weird denial of like, I want to be with this girl. I know I shouldn't be doing this. And how like at the end when he's having sex with her, in the desert and he's like, I want you, I want you, I want you. And then she's like, you will never have me. And then she gets up and walks into the cabin. And then there's a shot of him standing there naked. And they did such a good job of showing how vulnerable someone is naked in the desert alone.
But then that's whenever he turns toward the camera and it's the older guy again.
Yeah. And he morphs into the old man. Because, like, the old man is his insecurity. It's his fears coming to life. It's really strange. I don't know.
I like that interpretation. I think that's solid.
There's one other thing I want to talk about.
There's one other thing I want to talk about.
Okay, go ahead. You go ahead, because I forgot.
Mr. Eddie.
Yeah.
Mr. Eddie is played by Robert Loggia.
Love him. He's the mob boss, right?
There's this really iconic scene in this film where they take a mechanic out because they're like, there's something I don't like. I'm hearing something I don't like. So he takes a mechanic out for a ride. The mechanic fixes it. And he's like, let's go for a ride. So he takes them on this ride. And somebody cuts Robert Loggia off. And Robert Loggia is a fucking mob boss. So Robert Loggia runs this guy off the road and shoves a pistol in his face, a gigantic pistol in his face, and starts screaming at him. Like, I want you to go buy a driver's manual, and I want you to obey all the rules. And it's like, it's
one of the best scenes in the movie.
It's a crazy rant. That rant, here's the trivia. Robert Loggia really wanted Frank Booth in Blue Velvet. He wanted to play Frank Booth really bad.
Really?
And that went to Dennis Hopper. And somehow Robert Loggia thought he might have got it. And whenever he realized that he did it, he felt slighted. He called David Lynch up and screamed into the answering machine. And that is how he got the role in Lost Highway.
That's hilarious.
That's IMDb trivia, so take it with a grain of salt. But that's so fucking awesome to think about.
I mean, I'm going to say it because we're all thinking it, but Robert Loggia is no Dennis Hopper.
Oh, yeah.
Let's be real. But he did a great job in this movie.
Yeah. It's just a completely different character, but like, Blue Velvet was made for Dennis Hopper.
Yeah. Like, he is that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think Blue Velvet might be my favorite of the Lynch films.
It's
besides Eraserhead.
It's probably mine too, but there's something so surreal and upsetting about Lost Highway that I just can't get over.
Here's what's great too, is I knew I was going to be in for a good time when I saw it said writing by David Lynch and then someone else. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, no, it's the guy who did Wild at Heart. He wrote Wild at Heart. He wrote a bunch of different movies.
David Lynch cannot be just given complete control of whatever's going on. Because then you're going to get some, like, what was that film where...
the one that you hate, Inland Empire?
Yeah. Oh, Jesus. Where they like go inside the movie. Oh, yeah. My God. Get the fuck out of here. He just gets so insane. He loses the plot, and we need someone to like actually have a basic plot for him. So then he can insert all of his crazy fucking bullshit nonsense like Twin Peaks. And that's when it becomes good. Cause at least you're like, you can like follow a thing that has structure.
Yeah. But then again, I like how off the rails, batshit insane The Return is. So.
Oh, no. Well, you're probably the only one. I think it's like you and three other people who love that. Okay. Final thoughts, Dan. What do you think?
It's a great, great movie, but just be prepared for it to be a wild, insane, atmospheric ride. That's all
be
I can tell you.
Be prepared.
Oh, God.
I don't remember what my last point was going to be. I apologize about that. But all I'm going to say right now is watch this movie. Here's what you do. You get a big old tub of lube, right? You know? You get in your tub. You light some candles. You put in like bath salts. Not those type of bath salts. The actual kind of bath salts. And you turn this on your tiny tube TV. And then you watch this and you get all sexy, you know, you're just like, touching my body, yeah. Touching my body, rubbing them nips, you know, you're going to have a great time. You're going to love it. And there's going to be times where your dick is so flaccid or your vagina is so dry that you might pick up that TV and throw it in the tub. I don't know. Maybe.
Like the ring.
Yeah. I don't even know what I'm saying right now. I'm just riffing. But honestly, all jokes aside, this movie is fantastic. I loved it. I will watch it again. I might fast forward through the sex scenes.
Yeah.
Because I get it. I didn't this first viewing because I'm like, I'm better respect it because there is some very interesting, like the things he does with the camera and the strange, like there's a fight scene with the mob boss and the saxophonist when they're in the desert and his hand, he's like reaching out for something and then the mysterious man hands him a knife off screen. Yeah. It is the coolest fucking thing. And it's so bizarre. And I'm like, I've never seen that before. It's so weird. And there's so many weird things like that in this movie that I love it. 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 Okay.
All right, Jared.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate you.
Oh, you are so welcome. I'm glad you finally watched it. You can find us on Twitter at IndieFilmPod. You can find us on Instagram at IndieFilmReviewPod. You can email us at theindiefilmreview@gmail.com. Find us on Stitcher and Spotify.
That's right, baby girl.
Jared, tell us about the Necropodicon Network.
Necropodicon is a place where you can go listen to a bunch of really cool podcasts like ours. Like, if you like this podcast, there's a ton of really cool podcasts on there. Some podcasts that are similar to ours that talk about movies, and then there's D&D and other like role playing podcasts, which I like a lot. So I encourage everyone to go check it out. If you go to necropodicon.com, you can click a link to the Discord and come say hello to us. We have there's like giveaways, and you can buy like raffle tickets to like get video games and stuff. It's really cool. And there are like these like mini games now you can play. Like, I've been playing a lot of blackjack on it.
Mini games are fun.
And there's like roulette and like, I don't know, it's like goofy gambling shit, but it's all like fake money. It's not real money. But it's also, you can buy tickets to get into these cool raffles, which I think is, that's fun. If you're like bored, you're like on the toilet like me, you're like, I'll play this for a few minutes. But yeah, it's neat. It's just a cool place to hang out. That's what I really use it for. But okay, thank you all for listening. Dan, you have the final word.
Oh, mein Seiten Dekarschensleigen. Wrong. Seit ein Ninja ist ein Alien.
Hey, I'm Brad, and if you like D&D, and fantasy stories with lots of magic, adventure, strange beasts, and oddball characters, and comedians with New Zealand accents, then oh boy, have I got just the show for you. The Fate of Isen is a podcast that has, wait for it, all of those things. Remember those things I mentioned? It's got all of them! Now go listen to The Fate of Isen, because it's good, and you deserve good things. Fate of Isen. A proud member of the Necropodicon Network.
Necropodicon. Hard to pronounce? Easy to listen.